Hi, some of you, I think. I was here, I used to be at Night of E a couple of years ago, and it's good to be back. I moved off to the deepest, darkest city nearby, Sydney. Oh, but I'm back. So I live back on the Central Coast again. So much better. And Amy, my wife, and I, we go to 8:30 Sunday morning, so get into that. But it's good to be here with you guys. I'm pretty stoked to be able to look at Micah. And Micah, Old Testament prophet. What do we do with these things? I don't know if you've found this, but the Old Testament can be pretty hard sometimes. If you're anything like me, sometimes you find these kinds of books quite daunting. You're kind of reading through and going, I don't know what's going on here. I mean, if it's your first night at church here tonight, then you probably don't have any idea about the Old Testament, and that's okay. But for some of us who have been Christians for a long time, we still get stuck in the Old Testament and don't know what's going on. And particularly the little books, little prophets like Micah that we're just really, really unfamiliar with. It's such a different setting from where we are, and it's on the other side of we're on the other side of Jesus to it. It's way back when, and we go, what do we do with this? Like half the time, I don't even know who's speaking, and who are they speaking to, and what are they even doing? That place name? I've never heard of that place name. Look at my Bible map. No, can't see it there either. Like, what do you do, right? And look, for so many of us, the New Testament, it's so much easier. We just get there and we're like, oh, Jesus, tell me, you know, and we know what's going on. We spend quite a bit more time there. We find it much more straightforward. And so we don't end up spending as much time in the Old Testament, I don't think, which is a bit of a shame because there is so much gold in the Old Testament that we're just selling ourselves short. And if you're not yet a Christian, or if you've just become a Christian, then the New Testament is a great place to hang out. It's got the most important things in the whole Bible. But if you've been a Christian for a couple of years, or 10 years, or 50 years, and you're still not too sure about what's going on with the Old Testament, then you need to get into it. It's so good. And I want to challenge you to get stuck into it. God has given us such a good gift in the Old Testament. It makes up 2/3 of this thing. There are a lot of pages here, and there's so much gold. And it would be such a pity not to know what to do with this thing that God has given us. I mean, we are generally okay with Genesis and Exodus and, you know, a bit of Judges and maybe a bit of Samuel, King David. Yeah, we know Goliath. We know those stories. But after that, our knowledge really gets pretty shabby, doesn't it? It falls down a bit. And so I actually noticed this for me a few years back. I'd be reading through and the Psalms, like, they're good and there's some good songs in there, but I often just get there and go, what are you talking about? And I'd get to the prophets and just have no idea, which was really frustrating because I wanted to get into it. I'm like, this Old Testament, it's got to be good. It's still God speaking. And I'd be like, yes, come on, Old Testament. Really frustrating. But two things changed for me. I did God's Book, God's Plan. Such a good series. I think you got to wait for next year for it to come around again. But it helps you see how the whole Bible, and particularly the Old Testament, fits together. Really helpful. But the other thing, and I think this was particularly a game changer for me, was I resolved to read through the entire Old Testament every year. Right, back to the start. Malachi, back to the start, all the way through again. And that was about 8 years ago that I started doing that. And I've been kicking on, and it's been so helpful. So now all of a sudden, eight years later, there are places that I go to, places like Micah, even our passage tonight, where all of a sudden I read these things and I go, ah, that's talking about that promise that was made, or that warning, or that event, or whatever it happens to be. All of a sudden I understand some significance. The Old Testament has just come to life. I see God more clearly. I know him better. My view of God has just been expanded. And it actually helps me to understand the New Testament so much better as well. Actually, this week on Monday, as I was starting to plan for this sermon, as I was making my way through the Old Testament again, I got up to the bit in 2 Kings, which is Micah's time. How good's that? Like, this happens quite a bit. It's pretty funny. The Bible just keeps doing awesome things. I got up to the bit about King Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah, and I'm like, I'm a bit, you, right? Loving it. So good. So I can't I can't commend enough to get into the Old Testament. I kind of hit this up for a while already, haven't I? But what I thought I'd do tonight is with you guys, I thought we'd just make our way through the passage in Micah, and which is some reasonably unfamiliar territory for us. And I thought I'd see if I can't help us see some connections with the whole Old Testament, see what's going on. Just simple stuff. I made a point not to go hectic at reading all commentaries at the start. I want to just go, oh no, let's just think, can I just see these connections? And so this is something that we all can do. I'm no guru. I'm definitely not a genius. You can pretty much ask anyone that's ever met me before. I've just been working hard at the Old Testament for the last 8 years, and it's something that we can all do. I also happen to have the Spirit of God in me, which is something that all Christians have, and He helps us understand it. So why don't I pray, and then we'll have a crack at this passage together. Father God, we thank You that You have given us a big chunk of the Bible called the Old Testament. We thank You that You've spoken to us. We thank You that You've spoken to us from it tonight, and thank You that You've made great promises and have said great things. We ask that You would help us tonight as we work through this passage in Micah, that we would see You clearly, that our vision of You would be expanded, and that we would see some interesting connections that help us to understand You and what You are on about better. We pray that we'd become good readers of Your word. Amen. So we're here in Micah 2, and as you can see, Micah starts out having a go at some dodgy dudes. What is it, verse 1? Woe to those who plan iniquity, to those who plot evil on their beds. At morning's light, they carry it out because it is in their power to do it. Now, to have any idea what that's talking about, we have to understand the big context of what's going on. And Dan did some of this with us last week, which was really helpful. But we're gonna do it again, because if you remember Micah, he has this vision, all right? We see it in chapter 1. He has this vision concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. Now, these two places, they're massively significant in the Old Testament. And this is where our Old Testament knowledge starts coming into play, all right? Because what happens, right, what makes these places significant are these two major promises of God in the Old Testament. Now, God, He's made heaps of promises in the Old Testament, lots of good promises, but there are two real, like, kickers in there, the real standouts, and lots of you will be familiar with them. The first one was made to Abraham back in Genesis 12. Give me a nod if you know what I'm talking about. That's right. All right. This epic promise to Abraham, he promises him a land, the land of Canaan. We call it the promised land because it's the land that he promised, all right, the land of Canaan. And in this land, Abraham's descendants, they'll be a blessing to the entire world. They'll become this great nation. And what God is saying in this is, actually, I'm going to save the world through you guys. Something in this land is going to happen, and it's going to be incredible. It's going to be huge. It's going to be massive. And then we see what happens is Abraham has a son, Isaac, who has a son, Jacob. And Jacob has a bit of a wrestle with God, and God changes his name to Israel, which sounds familiar, right? The Israelites, you guys know them, all right? Now, the Israelites, they're the people of God because they're the people that God has made this promise to. He made it to Abraham, your family. They are the Israelites. And so we care about what happens to the Israelites. And we're expecting to see God keep His promise. Whatever happens to them, we're expecting God to keep His promise to them. Now, that's major promise number one, and it'll come into play in a second. Major promise number two can be found in 2 Samuel chapter 7. All right, write it down, chase it up later. It's a bit later in Israel's history, when after they're in the land and King David, he's ruling, right? And God makes him this massive promise, a promise that will establish David's kingdom. And one of David's sons or his descendants will be on the throne forever. I'm sure lots of you are familiar with this promise as well, right? Although all of Israel is part of God's promise to Abraham, he narrows this one in on David and David's descendants. And so he kind of narrows in a little bit. And so God has made these huge promises to Abraham and to David. And so as we watch Israel's history, we're really interested to see what's going to happen to these two promises. And by the time of Micah, As Dan pointed out, the kingdom has been split into two. The people of Israel, they're divided. Now, we've got that map back again. You can see the northern part. Poo! All right, imagine a map on the screen. And the northern part is... Oh, there it is! All right? The northern part is yellow, Israel, right? And that's made up of 10 of the 12 tribes. They're called Israel. They retain the name. And their capital city is Samaria, the first place that this vision is concerning. The southern part is Judah, and they've got the two other tribes, Judah and Benjamin, and they're called Judah. All right? Keep it nice and simple. All right? Not really. Now, they're all Israelites. Get this. They're all Israelites. The top people, they just get the name Israel, even though they're still all Israelites. So let's just keep this confusing. But what makes this split so intriguing is big promise number two, right? Who was it to? David, right? And guess what tribe David's from? He's from Judah, the bottom guys, the pink guys. And so they're the good guys, kind of, right? They're the guys that we're kind of watching going, yeah, this is where the action's going to be. This is where it's going to happen. We're expecting them to go well. Because although they don't have the name Israel, we know that God's going to keep his promise to have at least one of them be... One of them who are the descendants of David be the king on the throne forever. So we know that whatever happens to everyone, someone at least in that bottom kingdom is going to survive and going to kick on. And last week in chapter 1, we heard Micah give prophecy to the top kingdom, Israel, the yellow guys, warning that his judgment was coming, that he was going to absolutely wipe them out. But towards the end of chapter 1, all of a sudden there are some place names. Now, I did need my commentary for this. There are some place names that are actually in Judah. Moresheth, all these other places, that Gath, that are in Judah. And so he swings from speaking about Israel to speaking about Judah. And that's who he's speaking to in chapter 2. He switched to talk about Judah. And so... You know, we probably expect some sweet promises. These are the good guys, right? This is going to be awesome. But Micah's message from God isn't much more pretty to them. Because like I said, he's having a go at some dodgy dudes. And that's the context as we come. So let's have a look here again, all right? What we see is God looks down and sees some people with power taking advantage of others. Let's read verse 1 again. Let's look at the situation. Woe to those who plan iniquity, to those who plot evil on their beds, because it's in their power to do it. They covet fields and seize them, and houses and take them. They defraud people of their homes. They rob them of their inheritance. The picture we get is of powerful people taking advantage of others. They're stealing the land of others. They're chilling on their beds at night, which is just the time where we think, isn't it? That's all we do when we're chilling on our beds. We just think, all right? And how are these guys using their thinking time? Oh, how can I steal someone's land, right? They're just cooking up evil plans. They're plotting evil, and they're planning to steal the land of their countrymen, their fellow Israelites. And then in the morning, they get up and do it. Why? Because they can. All right, I got the power to do it. I'm going to steal your land, sucker. All right. And they're just cruising around. They're like, I want that. I'm going to take that. And they're getting rich. And they're the power brokers of Judah who are just being dodgy. This is just a cut and dried case of injustice. They're defrauding people of their homes and taking them for themselves. And Micah's clear, judgment is coming. God's going to judge these evil people. He's already said woe to them in verse 1. That's ominous. But look at his reaction in verse 3. Therefore, the Lord says, because you guys are doing this, I am planning disaster against this people from which you cannot save yourselves. You will no longer walk proudly, for it will be a time of calamity. Because of this injustice, God is going to judge Judah. He's not going to sit back and let it go. He's going to judge. He's planning disaster for Judah, and it's going to be bad. We've already seen his prophecy against Samaria, the northern guys, he's made this prophecy that they're going to get destroyed. And later on in Micah's lifetime, they get destroyed. They get obliterated. And here he pronounces a similar judgment on Judah. Did I say Judah before? I'm getting confused. Israel got obliterated. And now he makes a similar judgment on Judah. Look at the words of judgment. Disaster, calamity. You can't save yourselves. This is going to hurt. And verse 4 and 5 tells us that it's going to be in the form of getting booted out of the kingdom, out of the land. God's fed up with his people and he's going to bring them down. He's already used Assyria to knock off Israel. And now he's telling Judah that their turn is coming. Can you imagine how scary that would be? Like how you would feel? You've just seen your cousins get wiped out. The ones who haven't been killed have been dragged off into all these foreign lands. They're alone. They're no longer God's people. They're no longer even a people. And then you've seen that happen just after God said it would. And then Micah comes and looks you in the eye. And he brings another message of judgment. Now God's going to judge you, Judah. He's coming for you. And verse 3, you can't save yourselves. There's nothing you can do. Scary much? Man, this would be freaking out territory. This is the all-powerful God. How do you reckon Judah felt hearing that message? How would you feel hearing that message? God saying, I'm coming for you. Well, Micah actually records Judah's response for us. We can find out. Look at there, verse 6. Do not prophesy, their prophets say. Do not prophesy about these things. Disgrace will not overtake us. They hear Micah's message that God is about to judge them. And what do they say? Nah, he won't. You're joking. He's not going to do that. God won't do that. And we see in verse 7 that they're convinced that that's not the kind of thing that God would do. Your descendants of Jacob, should it be said, does the Lord become impatient? Does he do such things? That's what they're saying. God doesn't do that. God doesn't judge. He's never judged us. That's not the kind of God he is. Now, I don't know what planet they're living on, but their history has been full of judgment. These guys, they're so used to God's patience. And after centuries of God keeping his big judgment at bay, they've forgotten all the snippets of judgment back in time. Think about God's judgment in the book of Judges. Judgment after judgment. Or his judgment on King Saul. Or on David when he conducted the census that he wasn't supposed to. 70,000 people got killed. Makes our census debacle look a bit tame, doesn't it? Right? What do you mean God isn't like that? Does God do such things? Yes, he does. And Micah is telling you he's about to do it to you, Judah. They don't like the idea of a judging God. It sounds too harsh to them. They just want that patient, loving, forgiving God, not a God who judges. This angry God doesn't sound like the God that they want. They'd prefer a different God. And actually, we've seen them chasing after other gods, haven't we? But what about you? Do you like the sound of this God? A God who judges people, a God who'll bring disaster and calamity on his people. And it's not pretty when he does. The people of Israel, they weren't enjoying it when they got destroyed. And we wouldn't be enjoying it watching them. It's dreadful. God's judgment is awful. Do you like the sound of a God who judges? Judah didn't. But that didn't help them out in the end. Because they still got judged. Another incredibly important Old Testament event for us to be aware of is that Babylon, who became the superpower of the day just after Micah's time, they ended up attacking Judah and carrying them off into exile, off into Babylon. God did judge them. not wanting a God who judges doesn't stop you from being judged, ironically. God is a God who judges, and judgment is coming, Judah. That's the main point of the first 11 verses. And it's actually a pretty common theme throughout Micah. We heard it last week. We're going to hear it again. We need to take it seriously. But we do want to pause at this point, because this message of judgment, it's a strong reaction from God, isn't it? And whenever we see a strong reaction from God in the Old Testament, or the New Testament for that matter, we need to stop and go, why? Why is he reacting in this way? What is it about God that's causing him to respond in that way, in that circumstance? Because if we can work that out, it'll help us to understand who he is. It'll help us to expand our vision of God, of who he is. And getting to know God is what we're on about, isn't it? He's so good. We want to know him well. So why the strong reaction? I mean, yeah, these guys, they were doing the wrong thing. They were stealing people's land. Of course they shouldn't be doing that. But is that really enough to destroy the whole kingdom? Could it be possible that God's overreacting here? Is it just the angry God of the Old Testament? No, this is our God. He's the same God as the God of the New Testament. We heard the New Testament reading in Luke. Jesus gets angry. So why is he reacting so strongly? Well, it's because there's a clash between what these people are doing and the very character of God. These people are working injustice, and God hates injustice. God hates injustice. It's the rich and the powerful who are stealing the land of those who aren't strong enough to stop them. They're preying on the weak. They're using their power to just get more stuff for themselves. And rather than loving their neighbors, their vulnerable neighbors, they're taking advantage of them. Look again at verse 2. They covet fields and seize them, and houses and take them. Notice the word covet. They see something and they just want it for themselves. It doesn't matter to them that it's where other people live. It doesn't matter that, oh, their farms, that's where you get your livelihood. I don't care. I want a little bit more for me. I don't care that if I take it, you have nowhere to live for your family. That if you lose them, you've got nothing left. I just want more for myself, thank you very much. So they take the land, ruining people's lives in the process. Do you feel the injustice in that? God does. And he hates it. He hates injustice. How good is it we have a God who hates injustice? The Bible bangs on again and again about it. Micah is going to bang on again and again about it. And so I'm not going to labor the point. We're going to hear about it more in the weeks to come. And there's actually a deeper reason why God reacts so strongly. We're going to look at that in a second. But before we get to that, before we move on from the injustice of stealing people's land, you do realize, don't you, that we live on stolen land. When the Europeans came, they slaughtered and they stole. They established our country by stealing land, destroying thousands of Aboriginal lives along the way. This kind of injustice isn't far from us. It's our heritage, and it's dreadful. Now, what to do about it is hard. There's no simple solution. I mean, it's not as simple as giving back all the land everywhere. But if we're going to be like God, who hates injustice, we can't just ignore this issue. There are still many Aboriginal people and communities deeply hurt and affected by this injustice. They need help. Ultimately, they need Jesus, but they need lots of help. Now, helping them isn't our whole mission, of course. But what kind of people of God are we if rather than hating injustice and seeking to do something to help those who have been affected by it, we just ignore the issue altogether? We ought to hate injustice like our God does. and be active in helping those affected by it. But as I said, God's reaction isn't just because of that injustice. It goes a bit deeper than the injustice of land theft. It's not just God's justice that causes this reaction. It's also his commitment to his promises, his faithfulness. And this is where our Old Testament knowledge, I'm going to keep banging on about it all night, get used to it, right? This is where our Old Testament knowledge actually comes in and helps us out again. You see, an Israelite's land, their property was incredibly significant. Back when Joshua led the people into the land for the first time, the promised land, the land that God promised to them, the first time they led them in, that they divided it by lot. And so this tribe got that bit, that tribe got that bit. All 12 tribes got their bits, all right? And then the land was divided clan by clan, family by family, and they all got their little portion of land. They'd get their allotted inheritance. This was they'd have this land which was theirs to live in, theirs to have. And the law that God had given them actually stipulated that even if they got poor for some reason, they had to sell their land. Well, that's all right. They'll just get it back again. God set up this year of Jubilee every 50 years where what would happen is if you've lost your land for whatever reason, you just get it back. All right, old mates bought it from you. Year of Jubilee, thank you very much. I can just move back in, all right? And he's actually given them this security. It was yours again. Have a read, not now, of Leviticus 25. It goes into lots of detail about this. It's awesome. I wanted to almost read most of the chapter tonight, but just didn't have time. Sorry, but do it. Go and do it, all right? Some of the detail, right? If you need to sell it, don't worry. One of your relatives will just buy it back for you. You're sweet. But if you don't have a relative to buy it for you, don't worry. Maybe you'll get rich enough in that time that you can just buy it back. And if you've got enough money, you can just go and buy it straight back. No qualms. But if you don't get enough money, don't worry. Year of Jubilee. Go take it back, all right? And you just get your land straight back. And it just keeps going on. And it says, don't take advantage of your fellow countrymen. It just keeps saying it again and again. This year of Jubilee is awesome, all right? It just keeps saying it. Don't take advantage of one another. The exact thing that our boys in Micah are doing. They're taking advantage. They're stealing their land. If they're stealing their land, they're not going to honor the year of Jubilee. This system that God has set up is one of safety, of security for the Israelites. They can live safely in the promised land without worrying that they're not going to have a land to live in. And even if they have to sell it, they'll get it back again anyway. How good is that security? They don't have to worry about it. God cares about them having their land. And so it's actually a big deal that it's being stolen. But why does God care so much about the land? What's the big deal there? Why so detailed in his instructions? Why does it matter so much that the Israelites have security when it comes to their land? Well, it's because of big promise number one, right? The promise to Abraham. It's linked to the land, remember. This promise is for the land, for the people in the land. The Israelites will be God's people in the land of Canaan. And so when they get into the land, he gives them laws to make sure that they can keep it. Each of them can keep it. They'll get their portion. And that they can hold on to their portion. You get poor, don't worry. Year of Jubilee, you get your portion back. Because if they're not in the land, they're not in the promise. It's the promised land. It's caught up in it together. The two are connected. And so when these evil men are robbing their fellow Israelites of their land, they're essentially robbing them of the promise. They're taking away a key element of being the Old Testament people of God. But God, who made the promise, he's like, that's not happening. This is my promise. I keep my promise. You can't do that. I chose these people. What do you think you're doing? Robbing them of the land that I've given them. The land that I've promised them. Israel, or Judah here, they were supposed to be a nation who looked after one another. who displayed the glory of God, and instead they're stuffing it by stealing one another's land. And so the judgment is fitting, isn't it? They'll be booted out of the land. They don't get to take part in the promise. They lose the land and they lose the promise. The northern kingdom of Israel, they're no longer in the promise. They're no longer the people of God. And Mike is saying that the kingdom of Judah are about to lose their land as well. These people clash with God because he hates injustice, and they're working injustice. He cares deeply about his people, and ain't no one going to do them wrong. Not and get away with it, at least anyway. They clash with God too because they don't care about his plan or his promises. But he won't let Judah stop him from keeping his promises. He's like, no, I promised this land to this people. God is just and he's faithful. Can you see how the Old Testament starts to expand our vision of God? What a good God. But, and you might have seen the problem already, if Israel and Judah are the Israelites, the descendants of Abraham, and God has already wiped out Israel and he's about to wipe out Judah, all right, he's about to judge Judah. Oh, I should have used that, shouldn't I? He's wiped out Israel. He's about to wipe out Judah, judge Judah. Let's move on. Who of Israel's going to be left? Who's going to be left? It'll mean God's promises failed. And his promises can't fail. This is the God who promises and keeps his promises. And I mean, we know it doesn't fail. We know he sent Jesus. But how does it work if he takes out Judah? How can he judge them and then still keep his promise? And that's why it's so important that verse 12 and 13 are there. They actually sound quite odd when you first read them. Because the message has been judgment for two chapters. Judgment, I'm going to judge, I'm going to save. Like it comes out of nowhere. It just flips. Look at it with me. Verse 12. I will surely gather all of you, Jacob. I will surely bring together the remnant of Israel. I will bring them together like sheep in a pen, like a flock in its pasture. The place will throng with people. It sounds weird, doesn't it? I'm going to judge. I will surely gather all of you. What? Where did this come from? All of a sudden, we get this picture of salvation, this glimpse of hope. I will surely gather all of you, Jacob. Now, as we've been hearing in our gathered series, to gather is to save. That's what God does when he saves. He gathers people and he will gather all of Jacob. Now, as we heard earlier, Jacob is the dude who changed his name, or God changed his name, to Israel. This is the Israelites. God is going to gather all of Israel. He's going to keep his big promise to Abraham. But how can this work? I thought he was going to judge. What are you doing, God? Are you judging? Are you saving? Well, notice the second phrase there. I will surely bring together the remnant of Israel. How much of Israel is left? It's just a remnant. It's just a few. It's just a small little few. He is going to take Judah down, but he's going to keep for himself a small remnant. Which means that Judah's punishment will be slightly different to Israel's. Israel got completely destroyed as a nation. They're no more. They're kicked out of the land and they're dispersed everywhere. But Judah, while they will be taken down, because God takes their sin seriously, he will judge them, while they'll be taken down and, yes, taken out of the land even, it won't be to the utter destruction of the nation. Rather, the nation itself will only go into exile in Babylon. And then God will bring him back to the land. That's why Isaiah talks about the salvation from exile as the year of Jubilee. They'll get the land back. God will preserve a remnant of the people of Judah as he keeps his promise to Abraham. He did it in a small way in Micah's time, right? When Assyria, after they've already taken down Israel, 20 years later, they're like, oh, let's give Judah a crack. And they come on in and they're like, super powerful army, right? They rock up, take down all Judah, come to Jerusalem, siege, all right? Jerusalem aren't going anywhere. Hezekiah, the king, prays to God. God's like, yep, don't worry, I got your back. Slays down 185,000 Assyrians in one night. No, I'm preserving for myself a people. They run off. You can read that story in 2 Kings 19. It's incredible. God is on about preserving for himself a people. He preserved the remnant. He did it again when eventually they did go into exile, like I said. He then caused the great King Cyrus as much power as you can imagine. He can do whatever he wants. Oh, you guys, you want to go back to your land? Sure, I'm going to send you there. And I'll send 6,720 donkeys with you. You can read about that in Ezra. So many donkeys. There's like lots of animals and then like 10 times as many donkeys. What is up? Incredible. But this judgment, the judgment on Judah, is going to be different. He'll preserve a remnant of Judah until one day, and this is why he's preserving the remnant, until one day he raises up a king from amongst them. A king who is in the line of David. Big promise number two, right? He's going to rule forever. And that's why Jesus was a Jew. A Jew. He was both an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, big promise number one, and descendant of David, big promise number two. What is up, right? This is awesome. Old Testament, helping us understand Jesus, all right? But this king comes because our world is held captive to sin. Just like the Assyrians surrounded Jerusalem, sin has surrounded each one of us. It's laid siege to our lives, and it will only bring death and the judgment of God upon us. Us. You and me. Our sin deserves it. But God preserves a remnant. He preserves Judah so that he might send a king who, verse 13, breaks open the way and goes up before us so that we can break through the gate and go out. A king who will pass through before us, the Lord at our head. Yes, I changed a couple of those words to us, because this promise was for back then, but it's for us. In Jesus. Friends, this king is the Lord himself, the God who hates injustice, the God who judges sin, came to earth in the person of his son. He became a man in the person of Jesus, and he died on the cross and faced judgment himself so that we could be set free from sin. He's defeated the threat of sin, so that we could be gathered to him as the remnant of his people. That's what the church is. It's the remnant of God's people. That's what we are. We're the survivors of God's promise. We're the ones under the great promises of the Old Testament. No, we don't live in the land of Israel. Jesus won for us a land in heaven, one that is secure, that no one will ever rob from us. Not the devil, not sin, no one. It's secure because we have God preserving it for us. We have God preserving us as a remnant. And he will preserve us until we get there. God hates injustice and he will judge sin. Don't be under any illusions of anything otherwise. And yet he preserves a people of his own. He sent his son to secure them a heavenly land. that will be forever. That's us. If we trust in Jesus, are you trusting in Jesus for that? The alternative is like Judah, facing judgment. Come to the King for freedom. But if you are trusting Jesus, as I imagine most of us here are, I hope your view of God has been enlarged tonight. Your vision of God has grown. I hope you've seen God's right hatred of injustice. Now, are you like your God? Do you hate injustice? Do you fight against injustice? Do you help those who have suffered injustice? I hope you've also seen his faithfulness to his promises tonight. The way that he's worked to keep those promises over thousands of years. To preserve a remnant for himself. Us! Can I challenge you to keep enlarging your view of God? He's not a small God. The Old Testament helps us to see the goodness and rightness of God's judgment. It gives us a unique insight into the character and heart of God. It helps us understand Jesus so much more. Do you want to know your God better? Get into your Old Testament. Get stuck in. There's lots of it. Just read right through it. And then do it again if you want to. Get into it regularly and behold your God. Your King. The Old Testament is far from irrelevant. It reveals to us our God, who is the most glorious of all. That is something worth getting into.